You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI and Phil Clark from SOAS will join me to discuss allegations made by the US State Department that Russia has been firing artillery over its border into Ukraine. We'll be thrashing through that and the day's other big stories. Plus, Saima Tariq in Lisbon will bring us the headlines from Portugal.
Espírito Santo International has investments in Angola and Brazil, and because it's privately held, it wasn't subjected to the auditing that other national banks were subjected to during the financial crisis.
Then we'll hear from Sky News' diplomatic editor Tim Marshall about his new book on the theory and practice of football chants. And...
Who am I to tell you how to live your life?
Don't fool yourself too much about me.
What have you done, Joe?
We'll review the week's cinema releases, including the apparently not actually terrible new Nicolas Cage film, Joe. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. A characteristically action-packed 60 minutes ahead. Before all that, however, David Spencer has the latest news.
Thank you. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. The World Health Organization has called for a humanitarian corridor to be set up in Gaza to allow aid workers to evacuate the wounded. It also says that hospitals are running low on critical medical supplies. The call comes with exchanges continuing between Israel and Hamas and further violence across the West Bank. On the 18th day of an Israeli bombardment, the death toll has passed 800 and more than 4,000 Palestinians have been injured. Spokesman for the World Health Organization, Paul Garwood.
They are suffering shortages of supplies and other needs, particularly for surgical practices. We've heard bandages and gauze and these kinds of materials are of great need, particularly as a result of the daily increase in casualties in the area.
Meanwhile, Lufthansa says it will resume flights to Tel Aviv on Saturday, lifting a ban imposed in response to fears that rockets being fired from the Gaza Strip could pose a threat to aircraft. Earlier this week, the US Federal Aviation Administration lifted a ban on flights by US airlines. Israel had criticized the FAA decision, saying the airport was safe. French officials investigating the crash of an Algerian airliner over Mali on Thursday say bad weather was the most likely cause. All 118 people on board the Air Algérie flight were killed. Interpol is sending a team to help identify the victims, who come from 15 different countries. More bodies from the downed Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 have been taken to the Netherlands from Ukraine. An investigation into the cause of the crash is continuing, with British experts examining the flight data recorders. It's thought the plane was shot down by mistake by pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. The aircraft was en route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur when it came down, killing all 298 passengers and crew on board. Australia's announced it's sending more personnel to help secure the crash site. Foreign Minister Julie Bishop hopes they're moving closer to finding out what happened.
We have a very clear idea of what caused the crash, but there is more evidence on the site that will obviously add to the jigsaw of what occurred on the 17th of July. And we are determined to find who was responsible for this act and who is responsible for creating the circumstances that gave rise to it.
A Liberian man suspected of having the Ebola virus has died in quarantine in Nigeria. Laboratory tests to determine whether he had the virus have not been completed yet. He collapsed on arrival at the airport in Lagos and was being kept in isolation by authorities. It would be the first case of Ebola in Nigeria during this outbreak, if confirmed. The disease has killed 660 people across Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone since it was first diagnosed in February. The losing candidate in Indonesia's presidential election has launched an official challenge to the result in the country's constitutional court. Prabowo Subianto filed the challenge after the Elections Commission this week announced Joko Widodo as the next president. A Turkish court has ordered that 8 police officers be kept in custody pending a possible trial over accusations that they spied on Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan and his close colleagues. Many of those detained are among the police officers who carried out a corruption probe centred on Erdogan's inner circle that became public last December. They say the latest investigation is politically motivated. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24. It's 18:06 here in London, 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news is Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute and Phil Clark from London's School of Oriental and African Studies. Welcome back, both of you. We will start tonight with Russia, whose campaign of evasion vis-a-vis last week's shooting down of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 is on current pace about 24 hours away from saying the dog ate it. By way of providing the Kremlin with something else to concoct denials of, the US has now accused Russia of firing artillery at Ukrainian military targets from inside its own borders. Raphael, I'll ask you first. We have this from the US State Department citing intelligence reports, in inverted commas. All things considered, given the last decade or so, should we be asking for somewhat more convincing proof before we believe America?
Well, I mean, I don't know the sort of official statements that we're seeing coming out of the State Department. However, I think they're being confirmed from other sources that we're seeing on the ground, including sort of messages on social media and other places. I think we're seeing a lot of other compelling evidence. One of my colleagues at RUSI actually has been looking at this in some detail and said he's a Russian speaker, and so he's been following sort of Russian social media. And he says one of the funnier things that he's found is actual evidence of some of the soldiers, the Russian soldiers, who are sort of reporting on social media that they're exhausted after firing missiles into Ukraine all night and they just really want to take a break. And they're tweeting pictures or whatever the sort of equivalent of this is. So they're actually, you know, providing this quite compelling real evidence themselves. So I think, you know, yes, I accept the US has a awkward track record, shall we say, in sort of intelligence. But I think this one, it does seem pretty incontrovertibly that there is a link into Russia and official Russia too.
Phil Clark, of the many things I don't understand about this story, I would have thought, but there again, this may be why I'm not running Russia, that if one's proxies in the course of fighting a semi-deniable war managed to bring down a civilian airliner, that's probably the time I would have thought to de-escalate the situation. Russia appears to be doing the total opposite.
Yes, who can fathom the mind of Vladimir Putin? I think it shows just how completely unfazed he is by the events of the last 10 days or so. I've been reading all of these editorials saying that the shooting down of MH17 has been embarrassing to Putin and that he'd want to keep his head down.
You
would think. But I think all of that sort of treated him as a sort of normal, rational, you know, kind of linear thinking man. And he's clearly nothing of the sort. I mean, his popularity is soaring at home. The events of the last 10 days seem to have been an enormous domestic political success for him. He knows that he has the US and the European Union exactly where he wants them because they're so sort of linked in economically to Russia. So Putin holds all the cards at the moment.
Raphael, are we past the point at which Putin can actually be reasoned with?
I mean, I think that in a way we're looking at it from the wrong perspective. I mean, for him, this is all very rational behavior. For him, this is all exactly what we've seen him do before. He's never been one to back down from a problem. We've seen this repeated in the past, where if we think back a few years to Georgia, I'm always struck by the similarities of what we're seeing now.
Indeed.
And the sort of confrontation that the West is taking, the very confrontational line and saying, you know, if you do this, if you do that, we're not going to stop. And then nothing really happens. And I think Putin realizes that. And I think he realizes that the West, frankly, isn't ultimately going to go to war with him over this. And so he can kind of push as far as he wants. And, you know, he's he's going to lose face if he backs down. And I think it's very much that the mentality that we have to remember here.
But just to follow that point up, are there things that could be done that aren't? There's been various suggestions that the West could arm Ukraine. There has been suggestions that more could be done to expose the scale of the epic crookedness of Putin and his cronies. But the thing is, it just always, the two things that it seems to me are striking the EU. One is that it's very hard to hurt Russia without hurting themselves. And two, if he doesn't care anyway, what's the point?
Well, I think there are people around him who could be made to care. And I think this is what the latest round of sanctions seems to be trying to target. If you try to target some of the individuals around him, he's tried to really make it difficult for them to operate in the global economic system, then it becomes a more difficult situation. If you start to target some of these houses and properties and assets that they have sitting here in London, which they all like having here in London, then suddenly it would become a different equation. And then they might actually lean on him to do something. I think the idea of arming the sort of Ukrainian side and sort of turning this into a proxy conflict where the West is arming one side and the Russia is arming the other is frankly exactly not the way to go, because that will only escalate further. I think what we really need to do is need to get the Ukrainian government on the one hand to find a way of reaching out to these separatists, because they're the only ones who can really do that at the end of the day. And on the other hand, make it really unpalatable for the Russians to continue down this path of arming these people quite so aggressively. And I think that really is about targeted sanctions and actually following through on them.
Phil Clark, I should ask you, as my fellow Australian here, is it coincidental that Australia has, of the involved nations here with 28 citizens aboard MH17, taken by far the most robust approach, given that we appear to have the least economically to lose? But we have our foreign minister and former chief of the Defence Force in Kiev now, and talking about sending police and perhaps even ADF troops to the crash scene.
I think that's right. Australia's not as embedded economically in the Russia or the Ukrainian situation. But I think this is also about a small international power wanting to punch above its weight on the global stage. This is something that Australia has certainly done in the past. We have this seat on the Security Council as well, which won't last for much longer. And I think this is about Abbott trying to grab the moment while he can. I mean, he said some extraordinary things in the last few days. I mean, you would think that Australia almost unilaterally was going to sort of invade and kind of take over the crash site. But I think this is kind of a small country trying to play a big man's game.
Well, I dare say that we will be coming back to this saga in the imminent days and weeks. That being the case, we'll move along now to Libya. And it does say much about the scale of other recent occurrences that the world managed to largely overlook a week-long battle for Tripoli's airport, which has left dozens dead. In a hopefully more positive development, however, the ICC has upheld a decision to permit Libya to put on trial Colonel Gaddafi's former chief spook, Abdullah al-Sanusi. He'd previously been indicted by the ICC, along with Gaddafi's son, Saif, but it has now been decided that Libya's own case took precedence. Phil, I'll ask you first, is this a convenient climb down by the ICC, perhaps, who really can't make Libya do anything it doesn't want to?
I think it's maybe a little bit more complicated than that, in the sense that this is the very first time that the ICC has sent any cases back to an African country. I mean, various other cases have tried to get back to Africa, and they haven't worked. I think this is significant in the sense that it's a statement that the Libyan judiciary perhaps is getting up to speed in dealing with these very serious cases that could put Gaddafi's kind of spy chief on trial. I think it's a statement that national sovereignty does matter, and that there might be cases when the ICC has to back off and actually let a country like Libya deal with these cases. It's been a two-year kind of legal wrangle to get Sanusi's case sent back to Tripoli, but I think that there are a lot of advocates who've been pushing for judicial reform in Africa, and they'll see this as a very important move. They'll see it as a kind of stamp of approval that perhaps African states can deal with these cases on their own terms.
Raffaele, what do you think? Because obviously they have the extremely high-profile case of Saif al-Islam Gaddafi pending. Should local justice, however rough it is, and for these two gentlemen in particular, I suspect it's likely to be extremely rough. Should that trump the ICC?
Well, I think there's a question here in some ways about maybe trying to bolster the Libyan government and bolster their capacity and sort of responsibility of taking over the country and sort of clearing out the old debris. I mean, as you pointed out, you know, they've been a week-long fight that was going on around the airport. And that's only one of a number of incidents. I think if people were actually paying attention and saw all the attacks that we saw happening in Libya on a daily basis in quite prominent places around the country, I think people would be quite shocked at the level of chaos that's actually going on there. So I think something like this, which may help strengthen the credibility of the central government, is probably not a bad thing. And I think there's a value to that. In terms of the legality of it going to the ICC or locally, I mean, my inclination would be that I think if there is a local authority that can pass reasonable justice that is seen as fair and just, then that seems like the right place to do it. I think, to me, the International Criminal Court has always struck me as something which is more about when there's a situation where you're simply not going to get the local justice. I know Phil is a sort of expert looking much more at the sort of ICC in greater detail, but for me, it's always struck me as something that was like a sort of last recourse when there was no sense that justice was going to happen locally.
Now, what do you think, Phil? Because as you know, Raffaello was just reiterating, there is extraordinary chaos afoot in Libya. Is Libya, I guess, one, is Libya capable of putting together a case like this? And two, is this yet the time to be settling scores with the previous regime? Does Libya not have other priorities?
I think what's going on here is the ICC saying we at least have to give Libya a chance to deal with these cases. Mm. And I think legally that's right. That's exactly what the ICC statute says, that domestic states are supposed to get the first bite at the cherry, and it's only if they prove that they're unable to do these kinds of things that the cases end up back in The Hague. So I think that legally speaking, this is the right thing to do. Now whether this is politically the top priority for Libya at the moment, I think, is an entirely different question. And I think what we've seen in the past is these types of trials are very long, that they're very unwieldy, they're very expensive, and they can sap a lot of national resources that otherwise could be expended elsewhere. So I think the political question certainly does remain to be seen.
To what extent is this one really a warm-up event? Because realistically, the world's media is not going to pay vast amounts of attention to the trial of a somewhat obscure former intelligence officer. They will pay massive attention when Colonel Gaddafi's son, with whom I had tea at the Ritz many years ago, in slightly happier times for him.
How does he take his tea?
I can't remember off the top of my head. This was before he got into sort of furniture chewing, blood drinking, okay, son of his father thing. It's just when he was still trying to be the sort of urbane, reasonable voice.
It's your fault. You turned him.
Yeah, exactly. That's a pivotal moment.
I did also go to an exhibition of his absolutely dreadful paintings, which I should have possibly have read more into. But there will obviously be massive attention paid to Gaddafi's trial when and if it occurs. This is the fair trial he will be extended prior to his hanging. Is this a warm-up for that?
It could be, although I suspect that the ICC prosecutor is going to put up a much stronger fight to keep the Saif case in The Hague. The difference here was that there were already domestic investigations into the Sanusi case before the ICC got involved. So in that sense, it was easier for the ICC to relinquish that case, much easier for Libya to get a hold of it. It's going to be a completely different situation with Saif. My sense is that one probably will end up in The Hague, so we're going to end up in a very, very different situation there.
Okay, well, on that note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, as well as Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI and Phil Clark from SOAS. When we return, we will be looking at Shinzo Abe's South American tour, among other things.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks. It's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hippi, for The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me is Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI and Phil Clark from SOAS. Now, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has embarked on a 5-country tour of Latin America, which, it is difficult to avoid noticing, comes very swiftly indeed on the heels of Xi Jinping's visit to the same continent and the recent BRICS summit, which also saw India, Russia and South Africa meeting in Brazil, where they set up a new development bank. Raffaello, you first of all, what does Shinzo Abe think he's missing out on here?
Well, I think this more speaks to Japan's global sort of position. I think the trip through Latin America, I'm sure there are some optics and some purpose choice made. This was happening just after Xi Jinping's visit. We just saw some very senior Japanese officials going to a very similar trip around Central Asia, another part of the world where Japan used to be very influential and have substantial investments. And now China is really becoming the much more influential power. And I think in some ways what we're seeing here is Shinzo Abe is developing these sorts of international connections and developing Japan as an international power so that it's not one that lives constantly in the shadow of the US or in the shadow of China.
There is some suggestion, is there not, that he's trying to shore up support for this somewhat chaotic quest of Japan's very permanent seat on the UN Security Council?
I think that's something that the Japanese will always put sort of in front and center in their international discussions, especially when they're going to a part of the world like Latin America, where the perception is that they may be a less sort of relevant role. However, I think it is deeper than that. I think it is more about Japan as a global power and Japan showing that it is an international power. I think this in some way plays into sort of Shinzo Abe's sort of greater nationalism and about sort of remilitarizing the country to some degree. It's really about showing that Japan is an international power that has a sort of international voice and role, and that actually is a sort of important power in itself. It's not part of the BRICS group. It's not, you know, it's not part of some of these other international constellations that we're seeing develop. So it needs to show that it is out there, and he in particular has very much built himself up as a sort of leader of a new international Japan.
Now, Phil, what do you think? Is it part of that? Is this all part of Shinzo Abe's underlying narrative, which basically is that Japan has sat on the naughty step for long enough?
I think that is part of it. And then I think another part is sheer economic reality, that the Japanese economy has been a little bit shaky in the last couple of years. There have obviously been big questions around its energy market in the aftermath of the Fukushima disaster. And we've seen Japan out there looking for new markets, particularly those around energy. And particularly we've seen Abe in Africa over the last 6 months or so do no fewer than two trips to some of the big oil producing countries. So I think a lot of this is also just about pure sort of the economic situation at home.
Is it just resources, do you think, that are of interest to Abe in South America? What potential markets for Japanese produce are there in South America that he hasn't, well, that don't exist already?
I mean, I wonder whether a part of this is about things like Japanese electronics and Japanese cars, which seem to have kind of dried up all around the world. It's time to kind of open up new spaces. These perhaps are areas of new competition in industries that Japan has typically been strong in, but in recent years has been overwhelmed by the US, by China, and by others. So there may be a new sort of market push other than just a kind of pure look for natural resources.
Raffaello, it's a truism of democracies that there's no votes in foreign affairs, but I wonder if that's truer in Japan than most other places. It is famously an insular country by tendency. It is more of a monoculture than most countries, certainly in the developed world. Is Abe gallivanting around South America likely to excite the people back home much?
Well, I mean, I think there's something to the economics of this situation. I mean, they are looking for new markets. I mean, when we look to sort of Japan's international, you know, what does it sell around the world? It's very heavily focused on economics and sort of things which in some ways we can see other powers like China are starting to catch up to develop, or places like Korea developing to quite an advanced degree as well. So I think there's some degree of trying to build sort of access and connections to markets elsewhere. And I think that does play to a national audience as well. I think there's a very interesting question to be raised about the fact that a lot of Japanese companies used to use factories in China, and they're increasingly moving away from this. And part of this is they're moving away because of cost. Part of it is because it clashes with China and the sort of politics of that becoming quite difficult for them. But the other part about cost, it's actually interesting to think that some Japanese companies are considering moving their operations to places like Mexico, because by building in Mexico, they have direct access to US markets. And so you can build stuff there cheaper with a cheaper labor force and a place which has sort of reasonable infrastructure and access to various raw materials, and then sell it straight across the border into the United States. So it gives you direct access to markets. So I think there's some of that probably happening here, and that does probably have some sort of economic resonance back at home, which has some sort of political implications.
Well, back in China, there is some concern that Xi Jinping has decided that being the paramount leader of the world's largest country isn't quite sufficient, and is trying to consolidate still more power in his own office. He's installed himself in several other key positions, including bodies with decision-making powers over the military, foreign affairs, relations with Taiwan, and the economy, which it doesn't strike me leaves anything much for anybody else to do. Phil, are we witnessing megalomaniac tendencies here? Is he just the sort of, if you want it done right, do it yourself type?
He seems to be a very hands-on leader. I guess it'll remain to be seen with whether this is sort of old-style Communist Party leadership or whether this is kind of a new brand for the 21st century, which is somewhat draconian but perhaps not as bad as the past. I mean, this is kind of classic sort of authoritarian or despotic behavior, that the sort of which in my area in Central Africa we've become all too accustomed to, which is that if you can use the term anti-corruption drive, you can justify ousting almost anybody who shows any opposition to you, and you can sort of give it a gloss of trying to clean up, trying to modernize, you know, trying to do the right thing. In the process, you get rid of most of the people that you really don't like, and you kind of consolidate power around you. I mean, that strikes me as what's happening here.
Well, indeed, Raffaello. I mean, we have discussed this before. To what extent is Xi Jinping's anti-corruption drive basically a mechanism for whacking his opponents?
I think it's a very interesting question. It's one that we're not totally resolved about. I think what is abundantly clear is that since he's come into power, he has quite clearly been consolidating power around himself. He came in, he immediately shrunk the Politburo from 9 to 7. And of the 7 he appointed, only himself and Li Keqiang will sit in the next term. The other 5 are all of an age that by the end of these sorts of 5 years, they will have to be moved on. So then theoretically, he can appoint another 5 people. And there's even talk that he might shrink the Politburo even more to sort of consolidate around 5 people. I think this is also something that's being done quite consciously, because there was a sense that under Hu Jintao, while the economy exploded, so did corruption, so did a lot of other problems at home. And so there's a sense that trying to sort of clear out all that sort of problems and consolidate power to himself might be the sort of first step towards trying to maybe reform China. And the idea would be in the next term, with Li Keqiang and then the other 5 people or however many he appoints into the Politburo all being his sorts of people, he can actually push through reform. The dilemma is, and I think it's one that feels pretty spot on the money about pointing out, is that we've seen this happen in other situations, and it ends up with a despot who sort of continues to rule very much as he likes. And what we simply don't know at the moment is which way Xi Jinping is going to go. You know, the optimist says that, yes, he's going in a direction which is genuinely trying to clear it out. And I think what's interesting is the anti-corruption drive is going a lot deeper than people expected. It's not just taking out his enemies. It is taking out people who would be considered sort of part of his political tribe. And so possibly one could say that this is potentially quite genuine. I think the problem is that the problems within China are very, very deeply ingrained. And there's a whole question about how much it's more about the party structure that they have. And if it's about that, then the question is he enough to be able to reform that huge sort of beast?
Well, we will move along on that note to a country which is trying to leave behind the old school centralizing strongman. But celebrations in Indonesia of the election of a potentially transformative new president may have to be paused somewhat, because for reasons certainly surpassing my understanding, Prabowo Subianto, the thuggish former general who lost the vote to Joko Widodo, has announced that he will challenge the vote. Phil, this is bizarre, isn't it? This is not Bush and Gore in 2000. We are not talking about a few dozen hanging chads. He lost by 8 million votes.
Yeah, this is rolling the dice out of sheer desperation, I think. This was no cliffhanger at all. This was an absolute landslide, and a landslide that was predicted months in advance. I mean, I think what's remarkable to me is that Subianto actually allowed the election to go ahead at all, knowing what the polls were looking like in advance, or that he didn't try and stitch up the constitutional court in advance. He's done neither of those things, and so I think he's left with very little to do now. I mean, there is great hope, I think, in Indonesia that Widodo coming in is going to, you know, kind of mark this sea change in Indonesian politics. We've had, you know, 6-7 consecutive generals as president. Widodo's the very first sort of civilian president for a very, very long time, a former furniture maker, no less. So someone who kind of appeals to the sort of popular and the peasant movement in particular. So huge optimism there. And I think Subianto's push to kind of regain the presidency is just going to founder on whatever rocks he can find.
I mean, Raffaello, assuming Subianto is still on speaking terms with reality, what is he doing here? Because if this fails, as all common sense would suggest that it will, he has just painted himself in Indonesian legend as an absolutely preposterous sore loser, hasn't he? There's no coming back from that.
Well, or as he strengthened his position and said, you know, well, I was fighting for my cause, and so his supporters will see that he's really rallying and continuing continuing to try to fight, and so maybe we'll continue to support him. So come the next election, he can maybe contend it again. So I would say that it's not necessarily a case that this is a sort of desperation that's going to completely eradicate him from the Indonesian political scene. It's possible that, in fact, this will consolidate the power people around him, because they will see he is a real leader and he is going to fight and he doesn't want to give up and he still wants to lead the country. I think what struck me as quite interesting about this story is that, you know, we've already had a number of quite prominent foreign leaders, including Barack Obama, your own Tony Abbott, and Lee Hsien Loong of Singapore, have already had conversations with Widodo, sort of acknowledging it. And I think
trying to shore up a fait accompli as well, I'm sure.
Right, exactly. And say, right, this one's done and dusted. But then also, I think, you know, analysts seem to be pointing to this as a positive thing, and they don't think that there's really going to be much of a change. My sense is that I think this seems to be a leader who is, as you say, trying to do one roll of the dice. But I think it's more about consolidating and validating his political case rather than total desperation.
A final and brief thought on this, Phil. Conventional political wisdom has it that your best chance to make an impact is in that legendary first 100 days, especially if you've been elected as an outsider. How big a problem is this for President Widodo?
Yeah, this is enormous, because I think he inherits a real mess from the Subianto regime. He inherits an economy that's quite fragile. He inherits a quite difficult relations with most of Indonesia's neighbours. I mean, not just Australia, but also places like Ambon and Aceh and places like that. And a population that is hugely expectant, that voted Widodo in the sense that hoping that there would be grand economic change and real political transformation. So that's what he's up against at the moment, I think.
We will have to leave it there. Phil Clark from SOAS, Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And loads still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Simon Tariq in Lisbon will run through the news in Portugal. Tim Marshall of Sky News joins us to discuss his new book about football chants. And we'll review the week's film releases with the critic Anna Smith. But before all that, David Spencer has the headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. The United Nations agency that oversees civil aviation has announced an emergency meeting following the Malaysian airliner crash in Ukraine. It will discuss air safety in conflict zones. It's being claimed that the Boeing 777 was shot down by accident by pro-Moscow rebels. US Secretary of State John Kerry has pressed regional leaders to nail down a Gaza ceasefire as the death toll rises towards 1,000. Gaza officials now put the number of Palestinian deaths in 18 days of conflict at 822, most of them civilians. At least 15 people have been killed by Taliban insurgents in Afghanistan after an attack on two minibuses. At least three women and a three-year-old child were among those killed. French officials say poor weather was the most likely cause of the crash of an Air Algérie flight in northern Mali on Thursday. All 118 people on board were killed. It's been confirmed that a Liberian man who's died in Nigeria did have the Ebola virus. It's the first case of Ebola in the country since an outbreak that's killed several hundred people was confirmed in the region in February. Argentina says it's not possible to pay in full money that is owed to investors who've sued the country before a deadline of next Wednesday. The country is staring down the barrel of a second default in 12 years if it's unable to reach an agreement with the investors. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's 18:33 in London. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Earlier, I spoke to Monocle's correspondent in Lisbon, Saima Tariq. Saima, first of all, a few years on from the worst of the financial crash and the Eurozone disaster, Portugal appears to have actually started arresting people. This is quite big, isn't it?
It is quite big, and it's not the first time that Ricardo Espírito Santo Salgado has been accused of dodgy dealings. Last month, the bank was filing for help from its creditors in Luxembourg, and so it's already affected the economy. There's been shaky fears about it. He was arrested yesterday on charges of money laundering, tax evasion and suspected fraud. He was later released on a bail of €3 million. And generally, the country are quite happy to see this happening, considering that he is known here as the owner of everything. BES is a company that belongs to a family that has been running various businesses, from hotels, hospitals, banks. Espírito Santo Internacional has investments in Angola and Brazil. And because it's privately held, it wasn't subjected to the auditing that other national banks were subjected to during the financial crisis. So still not much is known about it and its financial situation, but it's been taking off stock exchange.
He's clearly an extremely rich and extremely powerful man. How much trouble is he in, and how much faith is there among Portuguese people that he's actually likely to end up in any?
Prison looks likely. I mean, if these allegations are true, prison looks likely. He has been replaced by a new CEO appointed by the National Bank of Portugal. It might have an effect on, as I said before, the various sectors in the economy. Portugal is still on track for its 1% growth, and it's still slowly coming out of the crisis. I don't know how many other skeletons will come out of the closet in terms of other CEOs of other private banks, especially with dealings with Angola, who were subjected to investigations from Portuguese authorities last year.
And what's been the general tone of press coverage of his arrest?
There's not been that much critical analysis. It's more been reporting. I mean, I've been seeing just mainly the main critics are coming from the left wing, the left bloc blog, which is saying that basically this, even though it's not been treated as a very serious problem, it's been isolated. It's been treated as a bad apple. The problem that this kind of exemplifies of European banking as a whole is the fact that retail arms of banks are funding investments that aren't being regulated enough. In general, the austerity measures are still really impacting Portuguese society. I think whatever happens with the Ricardo Espírito Santo Salgado, things will actually carry on as normal in terms of government policies towards banks and the austerity measures.
Okay, well, I wanted to move along now to another story about the community of Portuguese-speaking countries, which is a thing that exists, as regular readers of Monocle magazine will know, because we did a big Lusophone special a couple of years ago about the Portuguese-speaking world. One of those countries which is Portuguese-speaking is Equatorial Guinea, which has been welcomed into the community of Portuguese-speaking countries, not to universal acclaim, I understand.
That's right. It's the sixth African country to join, which of the CPLP now has 9 member countries. As soon as that happened, I mean, the president of Portugal was already had his misgivings about the joining, and he actually blocked 2 votes before. Previously, the last one was in 2012 for them to join. The connection between Portugal is very remote, actually, and there are more Spanish-speaking Equatorial Guineans than Portuguese. However, there are a group of NGOs, Portuguese NGOs, who work there in Africa, who are now suspending their activities there because they say they disagree with the fact that it will be joining. That's mainly because of the human rights abuses that they see as a dictatorship, basically, that still has a death penalty, that still has extreme mass poverty and is known as a very corrupt country. However, it is the third world largest oil producer. So it's clear, like, the trade relations that Portugal are trying to maintain or expand in Africa is becoming a sort of business club, according to this NGO, where they see the interest of an elite outweighing the rights of humans and the dignity of people who live there.
Is the community of Portuguese-speaking countries making all the predictable noises about how they hope that this kind of welcome will encourage Equatorial Guinea to improve its behaviour?
There's more noise, actually, about another bank, and this actually relates to the Espírito Santo story, because the CEO of another leading Portuguese bank, Banif, talking about how it's going to improve the economy, improve relations with Portugal, because there's going to be more investment opportunities. Apart from these NGOs, that again, the left bloc, they blocked the vote. The Socialist Party, a lot of them abstained. So there is quite a vocal resistance, but it's already gone through.
And just finally, we should talk about a recent influx of emigres to Portugal. Where are they coming from?
A lot of them are actually coming from France at the moment, at least people who are buying property. And that's not only in Lisbon. The Algarve has seen a huge boom since the financial crisis stopped a lot of the regular British buyers buying holiday homes here. I mean, as well as Brazilians and Chinese, the French seem, according to Bloomberg, they are leaving the tax regime, the heavy tax regime they're subjected to under Hollande's leadership, and buying property in Portugal. There is a program here called the Non-Habitual Resident Program for example, where foreign pensioners who come to live in the country can have their pension income exempt from taxes. There are also things such as golden visas, which are temporary, but until 2015, people of a certain income, and that's what's bringing a lot of the Chinese wealth as well, do not have to pay any tax on property.
That was Saima Tariq in Lisbon speaking to me earlier. Up next, Tim Marshall, Sky News' diplomatic editor, will join us to talk about his new book, a slight diversion from his usual subject area. This one's about football chants.
Spirit, love, energy, and culture. To be quickly accessible, unreroute the river, let the damned water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. My next guest spends much of his time caught in the front lines between groups of angry, hostile fanatics attempting to decode their vituperative rhetoric for a bewildered and horrified audience. But when he isn't writing books about English football fans, he's the diplomatic editor for Sky News, reporting from Afghanistan and Iraq, among other relatively restful destinations. It is in his role as a chronicler of terrorist culture that he joins me now. Tim's new book is called Dirty Northern Bastards, his words not mine, and other tales from the terraces. And it's a study of English football chants. Why do this, first of all?
I've been a football fan all my life. Congratulations on saying the word bastards on radio. Most people won't. And it's not... I loved your introduction because it's tribal. You know, it is about tribes and all the 25 years of running around the world watching people be unpleasant to each other. It's not that different on the terraces, except, hopefully, usually nobody gets killed, and it's fun. But I'm passionate about football. And the book is about football, but it's actually also about Britain. It's about how we view each other within this small island. I mean, there's 60 million of us. And on the front cover, it is called Dirty Northern Bastards. And on the back cover, when you flip it around, it's called Soft Southern Bastards. And to try to put it in a nutshell, I believe those two chants are rooted in the Industrial Revolution. That the view of the North, hard, tough, grimy, more working class, and the view of the South as wine-swilling, foreign film-watching, effete Southerners that just use our money that we make them. Now, of course, those are stereotypes, but the point I'm making is that most of the songs we sing to and against each other and for ourselves are rooted in the stereotypes of how we see each other in this island.
You're right there to talk about how there is a peculiarly British and very intense, very patchwork of regional rivalries, which still strikes me as strange after 24 years of living in this country. And I've got to the point where I explain to more recent newcomers to Britain, the key to understanding this country is to remember that the people who live here don't actually like each other very much, which is a huge difference in outlook compared to Australia, where I come from, or compared to the United States. But I was wondering whether you think there's something particular about football or soccer, as non-British people would call it, that lends itself to that kind of tribalism. Because I grew up watching Australian rules football, which has a very passionate following, but they don't segregate the fans. There's no real sense of us versus, well, not as ingrained and entrenched a sense of us versus them.
There's a bit of me that wishes that we didn't have to be, quite a lot of me, segregated. Because, yes, I mean, we all know the problems and there is the trouble and the violence, I'm afraid, and that is because of the minority within those that go. It does go all the way back to the tribes. It goes back to 130 years ago, where this city was rivaling that city, Manchester and Liverpool.
Indeed.
The Liverpool-Manchester ship canal, where basically the tax on things coming into Liverpool port they put up. So all the cotton coming in, going to Manchester to the mills, And they said, we're not going to pay those taxes. We'll build our own canal. And but that is now manifest partially through the football rivalry between those two cities, as is this north-south. I'll give you another example. If and when Newcastle would sing at Chelsea fans, you soft southern bastards, back will come the chant of speak effing English. Why don't you speak effing English? Now, we all speak English in this island, apart from, well, even the Welsh speakers speak English as well. But, you know, this idea that they're troglodytes living in caves up north, it's banter, which is sometimes a cover for really offensive stuff, but it is banter and it is part and parcel of ordinary working life in this country.
Will you make that point that there's a very fine line that football chants can tread? They are very often just witless mooing. They are occasionally genuinely witty, genuinely funny, these sort of weird spontaneous folk poems which just arrive out of nowhere. In terms of writing the book, though, how did you go about dealing with certain chants which, while being obviously patently offensive, are nevertheless genuinely inventive and funny?
Yeah, the hardest section was what we call the first half, because it dealt with that. I mean, the last one, which we call You're Having a Laugh Extra Time, that was the easiest section. I'll give you an example. Grimsby Town, well known as a fishing port, self-deprecatory humour. They take the English rugby song and they swing low, sweet halibut. That stuff's easy. It's funny. But the section one, the first half, I do deal with what I regard as three categories of offensiveness. Category one, you can have it as a joke, you can have it as an offensive, and it's debatable. Where's my hubcaps gone? People sing to the Liverpudlians. Now, you know, Liverpudlians are no more crime-ridden than anybody else. They're no more likely to steal your hubcaps than anyone else. But there has grown up in this country this idea of these cheeky, thieving scousers. And so in football terms, that is used against them. And I know scousers, I don't really care. On the other hand, you will get an argument that some of them think, no, hang on, you know, it's not good for our city. That's debatable. Category two is, and this is dangerous territory now, down at Brighton, allegedly the gay capital of Britain, the away fans will sing at the home fans, "We can see you holding hands. Does your boyfriend know you're here?" Now, the reason that's category two, because even though behind it is homophobia, that there's something wrong with holding hands with a man, which, you know, I hope we argue there isn't, but there's no malice in it. And that really is a mitigating circumstance. There's no malice in the chant. Yes, it might still be offensive. Then you go to the third one, and that's when racism starts. And I'm not trying to argue that homophobia is less offensive than racism. I'm arguing that the intent and the malice in category three. And so when people start using the N word, I would say the anti-Semitism. There's an Auschwitz song aimed at Spurs fans. That's just off the scale, you know. I think you do have to look at each chant in its context.
Did you get to the bottom of the thing that's always mystified me? When you get the genuinely spontaneous, genuinely funny one, where do they come from? Who starts them?
Wags. Look, working class humour, for me, is the sharpest, it's the roughest. I mean, most of our great comics came out of ordinary working life. They didn't, you know, I mean, look, there's lots of people from very wealthy backgrounds that can be incredibly funny. And Michael McIntyre, I don't know if he's incredibly wealthy, but, you know, he's from a very good background.
He is now.
Yeah. But it's working class humour. Let me give you an excellent example. Leeds away at Peterborough. Our manager was called McAllister at the time. I don't know why, but they had chlamydia testing vans outside. Can you imagine? Just be 5 minutes, lads. Just going to get... hang on. No, I mean, obviously not. But halfway through the first half, out came the chant, "We've got McAllister, you've got chlamydia." Now, you know, nobody made that up in the pub the week before. That was just spur of the moment.
Do you have a particular favourite chant that you ran across in your researches? Ideally one that can be repeated on air.
Yes. I feel quite romantic, probably, or emotional about what are called the signature songs. These are the ones that go back 100 years in some cases.
Yep.
Norwich is on the ball city. I love the Liverpool one, the Fields of Anfield Road. It's taken from the Fields of Athenry, an Irish nationalist song. It's not meant in a Catholic Protestant way, because Liverpool also have a song that's sung to a Protestant marching song. So, I mean, the religion isn't in there. But the Fields of Anfield Road, and there's one that was written by Harry Lauder, music hall star from the 1920s about the death of his son in World War One, and it was a hit in the 20s. And in the 50s, they were singing it on the Birmingham City coach and the fans heard it. And for the last 60 years, every single Saturday, this song about this man in the First World War who was killed is sung on the terraces. And I find that a great way of passing the passion down through the generations.
Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor of Sky News and author of Dirty Northern Bastards, an excellent book about British terrorist culture. Thank you very much for joining us. It's time now for a bit of music on Midori House. In a moment, we will be reviewing some of the week's film releases with the critic Anna Smith, one of which is the new Nick Cage movie, Joe. So to take us there, this is Joe Jackson, you see what we did there, with Stepping Out. Preposterously great record. Joe Jackson with Stepping Out, which, and I haven't looked this up, I think is from his Night and Day album. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. But anyway, you are now listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Coming up for the end of the show, it is time for our daily review of the best, occasionally the worst, when necessary, of the arts. Today we're talking film with the critic Anna Smith. Anna, welcome back to Midori House. I think at this late point in the human experiment, there is a temptation on hearing of a new Nick Cage film to adopt the brace position. And
yes,
just thinking,
indeed,
this is just going to be another 2 hours of Nick Cage doing that thing Nick Cage does, and didn't we all get the idea the first time? So, but Joe, apparently, is this... Does he finally break his long duck?
Joe is a really good one. It's his best since Bad Lieutenant, I think, which was several years ago. It's a very strong indie drama. He's got a great director. I think he's always good with great directors, but he chooses so many substandard films and just kind of phones it in. But this is with David Gordon Green, who did George Washington, All the Real Girls, very credible indie director. And Nicolas Cage is really very, very good and slightly restrained for him, but still plays an ex-con with some menace behind the eyes who could sort of explode at any moment. He's in the backwater of Texas and befriends a younger boy.
So you say quite restrained, so there's not too much bug-eyed gurning into the camera and jibber-jabbering, etc.?
Very little, very little.
Well, that's reassuring. We have a clip of Joe. This is Nick Cage in Joe.
What happened?
He's all beat up.
I can't get my hands dirty in every little thing. You know how I get.
Why you want to go back to the damn penitentiary, man?
Freeze, Joe!
Bring your mom or your sister. You'll be safe here.
Getting old, Joe. Yeah? Who am I to tell you how to live your life?
Don't fool yourself too much about me.
What have you done, Joe?
I don't know, bits of that sounded a bit Con Air.
It's very interesting, isn't it? That trailer makes it sound much more action-driven than it actually is. I mean, there is an action-driven crescendo without giving too much away, but in the main, it's a character-driven drama in the Deep South. So, you know, but then it kicks in.
And at the risk of giving away too much, what is the basic précis of what unfurls?
Well, it's a father-son relationship between him and this young boy who works for him. But the boy's real father is a violent man and he gets stuck in the middle. Vigilante possibilities there.
Okay. Well, we shall move along now to Earth to Echo, which, as far as I can tell, appears to involve insufferably cute children interacting with a robot. For those of us who have a fairly low tolerance to insufferably cute children movies, is there any reason to tarry with this one?
Well, I think if you've got a lot of nostalgia for E.T., it's the basic plot of E.T. It's about kids that find an alien who is very robotic, as you mentioned, out in the wilderness and befriend him. And he wants to get home, and the government, the authorities are chasing the kids and they have to get on their bikes. You know, there's a lot of similarities. Obviously, it's not as good. Nothing is as good as E.T. But, you know, if you take a 9-year-old kid, you'll probably enjoy seeing them enjoy it.
But is that who it's for? Is it basically aimed at 9-year-old kids in the hope that their parents will sit through it thinking, wow, this really reminds me of E.T., which was an infinitely superior film, by the way, this child doesn't know he's born, etc.?
I think that's fairly well summed up, yes.
And that's what I...
Why am I here?
That's just what I got from the trailer. It does clearly lack some depth. We have a clip of that one, I think, as well. This is Earth to Echo.
What was that?
I don't know.
There's something in there.
Whoa, 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 hold on.
What is that?
Did you see that just now?
Are those eyes?
Echo.
What?
That's what we should call it. This is amazing.
What was that?
Get down.
Gotta go, let's go.
If
those dudes are looking for Echo, they're looking for us.
Something's gonna go crazy again. Get ready.
You have to speak! You're thinking!
Echo, we need your help.
Now, if I've understood it right from my meticulous research, the tweak here is that it's done in kind of Blair Witch Project found footage style-y, shot by these unbearable urchins on their iPhones.
Exactly. There's a modern touch, a modern twist. And I actually quite like that aspect of it because it just gives it a fresh spin. And, you know, it starts off, they start getting weird, strange messages on their mobile phone and images that start going. So something that children can at least, of course, relate to.
Okay, well, we shall move along finally to Guardians of the Galaxy, which I believe is out Thursday. This is obviously completely preposterous, but it does appear to be kind of the point.
It's knowingly preposterous. It's preposterous with a huge smile on its face and a big thumbs up to the camera. You know, it just knows how silly it is. It's a Marvel comic adventure. And I think, you know, more than the Avengers and Iron Man, this just has a laugh with everything. Chris Pratt's very funny in this kind of Han Solo stroke Indiana Jones Space Crusader role. And for every little serious moment, there's a knowing wink and a knowing gag.
Okay, well, we have a clip of that as well.
We will not stand by as evil
wipes out billions of innocent lives.
Why would you risk your life for this?
Because right now, life's giving us a chance.
If we don't protect the galaxy, who will?
We'll follow your lead.
Oh, yeah.
I have a plan. You've got a plan. I have part of a plan.
That's a fake laugh.
It's real!
American movie trailers do all sound literally exactly the same. All those three trailers we have played have sound exactly indistinguishable from each other. Guardians of the Galaxy did have a maniacal cackle at the end of it. Are there other kind of space opera romps that this reminded you a bit of?
Yeah, Star Wars, some Star Trek, even Red Dwarf. You know, there's these kind of
Good
misfits,
God.
A band of misfits in space. Or, you know, one of them's actually a talking raccoon. That's what you obviously didn't get from the audio trailer, voiced by Bradley Cooper. So that's actually quite amusing. It's got heart, it's got humour. The action is a little bit overwrought in my view, but it's going to be huge. People are going to love it.
It has a gun-toting raccoon and a talking tree.
Yeah, what more do you want?
Clearly several explosions. That's Guardians of the Galaxy out in London and thereabouts on Thursday, the final selection of our guest film critic Anna Smith. Many thanks for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks also to our earlier guests Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI and Phil Clark from London's School of Oriental and African Studies. The show was produced by Alad John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Joel Church. Next up after the headlines is this week's edition of The Menu with Marcus Hippie. And then at 2200 hours, The Monocle Daily is back, hosted by me and Emma Nelson. This show returns on Monday at 1800 London time, I think also hosted by me, you lucky people. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life. A benchmark for style.